Well, this fifth and last sense of the term aesthetics was something very relevant to Wittgenstein's way of handling problems connected with aesthetic matters. And in a well-known remark from 1937, he contrasts this kind of critically reflective relationship to the individual work of art with philosophical activity. He, in fact, points out that there seems to be, quote, a queer resemblance between a philosophical investigation and one in aesthetics, unquote. Seymour Aloise and I, we had a conference this summer just on that, Sam. So, this is considered quite relevant and very much to the point if you try to look into how Wittgenstein conceived his own philosophical method. Then this fifth sense of aesthetics is also to the point, since he connects them. And close to the end of his life, in 49, he uses the same contrast here to say something about what really occupies him and concerns him. He expresses himself thus: scientific questions may interest me, but they never really grip me. Only conceptual and aesthetic questions have that effect on me, unquote. The conceptual is in this case, of course, a metonymic expression for philosophical activity, and is treated as something clearly distinct from the aesthetics, even if Wittgenstein did see a queer resemblance between the two kinds of undertakings. It is therefore especially important to realize that of these contrasted activities, aesthetic has to do with our own use of language in direct encounters with individual works of art. Something which, for the sake of simplicity, we could call language use in the basic aesthetic situation. These observations concerning Wittgenstein's somewhat idiosyncratic use of the term aesthetics will hopefully also help to correct certain typical misreadings of the above-mentioned lecture transcripts. You have to be very careful when Wittgenstein talks about aesthetics, because he has a repertoire of different meanings. Well, let's then take a step further and look at this rather daring opening of his 1938 lectures, and look into what kind of misunderstandings might Wittgenstein have in mind, because he does not say anything more about this is the first misunderstanding and this is the second, etc., etc. Oh, no, not at all. He goes on with his business talking about particular works of art and particular ways of expressing yourself when you talk about these works of art, etc., etc. So, there is a task for a researcher in trying to spot what on earth could these misunderstandings be? On both occasions, when lecturing on aesthetic matters, Wittgenstein began by attacking the concept of beauty. He was no doubt of the opinion that, quote, the concept of the beautiful has done a lot of mischief here too. He says, a remark that is occasioned by Grillparzer's attitude towards the music of Mozart. Interesting muser. Mozart's spoiled by the beautiful. That's quite an intriguing thought. Well, in the 1938 lectures, he commences in medias res, as his audience is a select group of students that are more or less familiar with his broader views on language, meaning, and the nature of concepts. So quite a lot can be presupposed in these lectures. In the 1933 lecture, he talked to a group of a wider group of people, mainly consisting of mathematicians, and that made him slow down and be more circumstantial in his way of presenting the matter. And according to George Edward Moore, who made one of the two existing transcripts of the 1933 lectures, he said the following. Now I quote Moore, George Edward Moore. He introduced his whole discussion of aesthetics by dealing with one problem about the meaning of words, with which, he said, he had not yet dealt. He illustrated this problem by the example of the word game, with regard to which he said both, one, that even if there is something common to all game, it doesn't follow that this is what we mean by calling a particular game a game. And two, that the reason why we call so many different activities games need not be that there is anything common to them all, but only that there is a gradual transition from one use to another, although there may be nothing in common between the two ends of the series. And he seemed to hold definitely that there is nothing in common in our different uses of the word beautiful, saying that we use it in 100 different games. That is, exemplia gratia, the beauty of a face is something different from the beauty of a chair or a flower or the binding of a book. And from this opening we see that it is the problems concern associated with the meaning of words which he regards as primary. It is here that pictures are created that bewitch our thinking, as he became fond of putting it some years later. In the 1938 lecture, after his rather strong opening remark quoted earlier, he goes straight on to illustrate some of the misunderstandings which he has in mind by saying, quote, the use of such word as beautiful is even more apt to be misunderstood if you look at it in the linguistic form of sentences in which it occurs than most other words. Beautiful is an adjective, so you are inclined to say This has a certain quality, that of being beautiful. Once again, it is the most loaded category of traditional aesthetics, beauty, which is here used as the starting point for his reflections. And once again it crops up in its adjectival form. But our prime concern is no longer to dismiss the search for the thing that all beautiful objects might have in common. The critique here in 38 lectures, compared to the 33 lecture, goes deeper and is considerably richer in implications. It is a matter of the misunderstandings which arise from attending exclusively to the form of aesthetic utterances, as I quoted earlier as one big mistake by a contemporary philosopher. The target here is an aesthetic built around an analysis of the Kantian type of proposition, this X is beautiful, because Kant's aesthetics is in its totality built upon an analysis of that sentence form. In today's terminology, this is the model for singular subject predicate propositions. By allowing the form of such propositions to determine our thinking about beauty and other central aesthetic concepts, we are misled into thinking that we can infer things about the structural features of states of affairs in the world from the structural features of propositions. In other words, we are tempted to reason from language to reality. In order to clarify what is implied by Wittgenstein's argument here, we have to spell out the contextually implied assumptions to see why we are inclined to look upon beauty as a property. The reasoning may be reconstructed as follows. A. All our concrete judgment about beauty are of subject predicate form. And B, a predicate always signifies or stands for a property. That are the two most basic premises. And then we from this conclude that the object in question has the property of being beautiful. This kind of quasi-formal reasoning is meaningful only within a traditionally established framework of conditions. It might therefore pay off to spend some time bringing forth the most important of these assumptions. The first of them is that it is taken for granted that all aesthetic judgments are of the subject predicate form, and they all treat of particulars. This is obviously too narrow a view of the matter. One of Wittgenstein's own examples may neatly illustrate this. And this is a quotation from Philosophical Investigations. When you see it like this, you see where it goes wrong. This you find in the classical edition of Philosophical Investigations on page 202, where he uses as a reminder what we say about works of art. Another misunderstanding is indirectly suggested in Wittgenstein's opening remark. In concentrating the analysis around the concept of beauty, we obscure the relevance of a great many other aesthetic categories, which, in Wittgenstein's opinion, are far more important than beauty. For in the basic aesthetic situation, it hardly ever happens that someone characterizes a thing as beautiful and leaves it at that. Only people with a very limited aesthetic experience who cannot express themselves properly would be tempted to use words like beautiful, lovely, fine, etc., is what Wittgenstein indicates at this point in the lecture. These two misunderstandings are linked to the first premise of my reconstruction of the argument implied in Wittgenstein's introductory remark. But if we are to arrive at something that looks like a valid reasoning, we must also make explicit another notion that the lectures assume within their intellectual horizon. And this I have done in formulating the second premise, and that is the kind of theory of meaning that Wittgenstein attacks in the first 64 paragraphs of Philosophical Investigations. This premise asserts that from a logical point of view, a predicate always signifies or stands for a property. Few assumptions in the field of formal logic are richer in implications for any theory of meaning. The fourth and fifth misunderstandings are bound up with a variant of what Wittgenstein calls a primitive idea of meaning, about the meaning of words in the human language. And that is the idea which Wittgenstein himself describes in the beginning of Philosophical Investigations in this way. Every word has a meaning. This meaning is correlated with the word. It is the object for which the word stands. Unquote. The argument which we reconstructed above is concerned with property words and what they stand for, namely the properties of things, that is, works of art in our case. And it is here we find the philosophically problematic assumptions. For lurking on the horizon is the verification theory of the proposition's meaning with its accompanying demand that it should be possible to formulate the meaning of any scientific or philosophical proposition by means of a single set of conditions for the use of the expression. This requirement implies that to qualify for use in a philosophical or scientific context, each and every term has to be definable, such that firstly, the various conditions for its use are logically necessary, and secondly, there is one and only one sufficient set of such conditions. And at this point, it is important to remember that these lectures were given in 1938 in the heydays of logical positivism. For this fact must surely have influenced Wittgenstein's choice of words. Yeah. However, the requirement that the language of philosophy and science should consist exclusively of expressions which are either primitive elements of a system or can be defined once and for all goes, in fact, back to antiquity. Both Plato and Aristotle have dark moments when they say things like this. But this indicates that Wittgenstein moves in a landscape that is familiar to his students, and that's why he doesn't have to say all these things to them. But these primitive ideas which he tried to refute in philosophical investigations concerning meaning are also present in the way we speak about art. And Wittgenstein was quite fond of discussing ideas of this kind as pictures. He called them pictures, which held us captive. Paragraph 115 in Philosophical Investigations. And they guide at the same time our attention, according to Wittgenstein. And such pictures are continually being created and repeated in language. It is these that enable language to bewitch our intelligence when we are doing philosophy, as Wittgenstein puts it in paragraph 109 in Philosophical Investigations. To believe that beauty is a property of a thing is thus the result of having been bewitched by a simplified picture of the relationship between language and reality, whereby each and every adjective is assumed to stand for or signify a property of the object or class or object referred to by the expression that takes the subject position in a subject predicate a proposition. And our understanding of such propositions is in turn anchored in assumptions relating to the theory of meaning. This is why the form of the proposition is able to dazzle and mislead the practitioners of traditional aesthetics when they strive to clarify the concept of beauty and all the other fundamental categories of aesthetics. It is also the reason why Wittgenstein characterizes this as the main mistake made by philosophers of the present generation. If you should happen to foster the heretical thought that Wittgenstein here is chasing ghosts in traditional aesthetics, I can provide you with a few examples from the philosophy of art around 1938, when the lectures were given. The first one is the opening section of the article The Nature of Art, which was written by the American philosopher DeWitt H. Parker. He was quite famous at that time. The article was published in 1939, and the opening section sounds like this. The assumption underlying every philosophy of art is the existence of some common nature present in all the art, despite their differences in form and content. Something the same in painting and sculpture, in poetry and drama, in music and architecture. Every single work of art, it is admitted, has a unique flavor, je ne sais quoi, which makes it incomparable with every other work. Nevertheless, there is some mark or set of marks which, if it applies to any work of art, it applies to all works of art and to nothing else. A common denominator, so to say, which constitutes the definition of art and serves to separate, though not to isolate, the field of art from other fields of human culture. Here, most of the intellectual prejudices commented upon above are contained in one consecutive paragraph. And the very first sentence in another very famous contribution to aesthetics, namely Collingwood's book, The Principles of Art, reads, quote, "The business of this book is to answer the question, what is art?" Unquote. Here, an unadulterated essentialism is presupposed in this sort of procedure. We noted earlier that Wittgenstein's somewhat idiosyncratic use of the term aesthetic made us address the use of language in direct encounters with individual works of art, the basic aesthetic situation. Let us therefore take a closer look at the kind of discourse that characterizes these basic aesthetic situations, and spend a few remarks on what Wittgenstein called grammatical explanation in the 1938 lectures. The idea of a logico-grammatical investigation was by no means fully formed in 1933, when he gave his first lecture on aesthetics. Nonetheless, Moore's transcript of Wittgenstein's lecture contains mention of something which Wittgenstein calls the grammar of discussion. A person can make use of various methods and means in trying to persuade another person that a certain work of art is to be looked upon in a certain way. And according to Wittgenstein, the various strategies we adopt for doing this determine the meaning of the terms used in the ongoing discussion. Each way in which one person convinces another, quote, fixes the grammar of that discussion, unquote. This is, by the way, the first indication we find of an idea of a logical or grammatical inquiry in an aesthetic context. This preliminary sketch also contains something else of particular interest. For Wittgenstein focuses attention on the dynamic nature of such discussions and emphasizes that this is a creative factor as far as meaning is concerned. The dialogical movement of the aesthetic discourse can thus be regarded as something which in itself creates meaning. That which is particularly dynamic is set in the foreground in contrast to what is typical in the late philosophy, when Wittgenstein points to matters of a logical, grammatical nature. For here, the primary concern is to eliminate the factors that constitute the meaning of a certain expression in a certain practice or context. In other words, factors which can be regarded as already established in terms of their meaning. If the dialogical grammatical model had been retained as sketched here, it would have been given a finely balanced picture of the logico-grammatical aspect of the aesthetic discourse, between, on the one hand, the reminders, die Erinnerungen, of meaning constitutive factors which have already been established, and on the other hand, the mechanism that facilitates the continuous creation of meaning in conversations on aesthetic matters. In his later texts, this particularly creative aspect is toned down, but it doesn't completely disappear. Indeed, the entire later philosophy is built around a picture of human language which presupposes, firstly, a constant awareness for the totality of prevailing practices which constitute the conditions necessary for the maintenance of those meanings that have already been fixed, and secondly, forever recurring confrontations with radically new situations which call for a creative response on the part of the language user. And regardless of any other changes in his thought, for the remainder of his philosophical active life, Wittgenstein was consistent in maintaining that it is the logical grammatical factors which we need to keep in focus. For it is a clear view of these factors which affords us insight into the prevailing or particular mode of understanding. This is more or less anticipated and indicated by the comparison Wittgenstein makes towards the end of the 1933 lecture on aesthetics, because there he looks into the character of Freud's explanations in psychoanalysis and the kind of use explanations have in aesthetics, in his sense of the word aesthetics, that is. He remarks that, quote, "The display of elements of a dream is a display of similes. As in aesthetics, things are placed side by side so as to exhibit certain features. These throw light on our way of looking at a dream." Unquote. To place things side by side, a typical feature of the form of argument characteristic of aesthetic discourse, is thus a means of illuminating certain responses that have been established within the linguistic community to convey what we understand, dreams to be. In other words, Wittgenstein regards these responses as expressions typical of the particular concept of a dream which we have at our disposal. And the logical grammatical remarks are ways of indicating the character of the concept. According to Wittgenstein's 1938 lectures, the kind of response we are talking about here becomes more apparent if we ask ourselves, how did we learn "I dreamt so and so"? In the practice of language games that use color words, for instance, we can point to one of the colors in a color chart and say, this is red. But we can't proceed in that way in teaching someone the meaning of the word dream. For here, there is nothing to point to. Nevertheless, it is possible, even here, to convey how the word is used. We have to refer to situations in which dreams occur, namely during sleep. we have to comment upon how we react to dreams, that we describe them to others, that we have a certain interest in interpreting them, etc. That they are an integral element of normal conscious life, and so on. These are the kind of responses which it is the task of a logical grammatical investigation to illuminate. They tell us something about the place dreams occupy in our lives. Once a child has learned to use the term dream in this context, it can be said to have a command of the concept of dreams that has been established within our linguistic community. This is how we acquire the concept of a dream. Analogically, we may say of the logical grammatical investigations of the aesthetic discourse unfolding in our immediate traffic with particular works of art, that they are in fact contributing to illuminate the place that art and aesthetic experiences have in our lives in an indirect way. And that is quite in line with the declared purpose of Tractatus. It is a matter of seeing the world aright, even if the methods are decidedly different. Wittgenstein is thus, in his aesthetics, not just tearing down houses of carves. He is also aiming at providing us with an insight that might help us see the field of art and aesthetic experience aright. That is, according to the interpretation I